all back in the court, I don't know what happened.
We'd like to bring the meeting to order. Call the roll.
Darren Garrett.
Present.
Mike Lynch.
Present.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Manger.
Here.
Mandy Dillon.
Here.
Rhonda Biesmeyer.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Are there any announcements?
I do have an announcement. There are two changes that need to be made to the minutes. It will reflect we need to add two staff members that were present at the last meeting, which were Don Lee and Chris Wisdom. The second change was a correction to trustee Garrett's arrival time. It will be changed from 2:52 to 1:52.
Is there anyone here from the public who wishes to make a comment on an item that's not on the agenda? Okay, we will dispense with reading those rules. The consent calendar. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second. And that's what the changes?
Yeah. It's been moved and seconded to adopt the consent calendar. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. And we have address.
This is item 6A. This is an information item only, and this is a discussion about private debt, an education session again on private debt. And just to remind the board, last month there were some questions on the performance of our direct lending asset class and the opportunities and dislocations that may or may not still exist in this asset class. And so we've decided to have Ed give us an additional primer on the asset class at this point in time.
Sorry, I was getting a point. So we also have our flash report, I think.
That'll be later.
Okay, thank you. So let's dive into the piece on direct lending. So I'll be referencing this separate handout, which I think you all have in front of you. It has a picture with some trees on the front. diving into page 4, we have the executive summary. So I think this is much aligned with what Rick just said, following up on the last meeting where we had some more detailed discussion about the performance and the fees related to direct lending. And then we also mentioned that White Oak would be invited to this board meeting. So we wanted to provide then this just for educational purposes. So let's take a look then as we turn to page 6. This gives us a quick schematic of how companies borrow money. A lot of detail in the schematic, but it doesn't really need to be overdone. What we're basically saying is on the left-hand side, the larger companies, when we get into the syndicated loan market, there are multiple steps involved, including the involvement of banks. Think of them as investment banks creating the syndicate and then creating the secondary market for the transactions and buying and selling of syndicated loans, much like the high yield market. Whereas direct lending is a much more simplified model on the right hand side, where the borrower is working with what we call here a club. It's not formally a club, you don't have to get membership to a club, but it's kind of a club in the sense that you have PE sponsors arranging the debt financing for the companies. And then Fund 1, 2, and 3 are examples of what we would be investing in and have invested in direct lending funds. So that's the purpose of that slide, to just give the comparison there. I think we're familiar with all of that, but if there are any questions. If not, then we can move on to page 7, take a look at some of the key characteristics with direct lending loans. They tend to be smaller, and so here we highlight that we're generally targeting middle market loans, and we say 10 to 75 million in EBITDA. And I think you hear a lot of strategies that just kind of focus on 50 million and below. And so there are a lot of statistics about $50 million in EBITDA. The question then is, what is EBITDA? That's the company's earnings before several things: interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So if you take a company's earnings before those four carve-outs, you can get a pretty good assessment of how the company generates cash. And that's kind of a quick, handy way of saying, does this company generate cash before this certain set of non-cash or other related items, interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So the idea there is, let's take a look at companies that generate that much in EBITDA, and then we can figure out what their lending needs are, and that's how direct lending kind of really works. The second bullet point is that they're unrated. So when you have larger companies that go to the high yield market or the investment grade market, they're hiring a rating agency to come in and assess their credit worthiness. And that rating agency takes a look at their financials, the stability of the organization, the industry, all these competitive dynamics, and says, okay, here's how safe we think they are as a credit risk. And that could be AAA, that could be down into the C or D. D would be kind of default. So you have this assessment by an independent rating agency to say how safe it is, the credit worthiness. In this case, we don't have that. So the direct lending strategies really rely on the underwriting capabilities of the investment managers investing in them. So they kind of have to perform all of the same work, and it's up to us to test whether they're good at doing that. So the credit rating part is pretty critical here. Third bullet point, they're illiquid. So once these loans are made, it's not easy to buy and sell these loans. There's not a secondary market for them. Fees are an important part because fees, not only the fees that we pay to the investment managers, but the fees that the companies pay to get these loans is what we're highlighting here, loan arrangement fees and prepayment penalties. This is important because the investment managers can make money off of these components as well. And so there's the loan origination fee, which typically covers the costs of originating the loan. Prepayment penalties help deter the borrowers from prepaying the loan. Probably like what most of us have thought about in terms of our own home mortgages, that we typically have friendly prepayment clauses so that we can prepay. These are not as friendly. So if you want to prepay this loan, you're going to have to pay a penalty of some sort to do it, and that encourages the borrower to stay in the loan. And then covenant protection. So here we highlight that these private lenders often require greater covenant protection in number and types. And this is important because the covenants are a key dynamic of what we saw back in 2008, what we're seeing again today in this environment, where we're seeing more and more cov-lite loans. The covenants are lighter, and therefore there aren't as many requirements for the company to meet in the process of satisfying their loan. Now, that then raises questions for us to say, okay, so investment manager, if you're involved in this space, and the market is saying that the trend is to more and more covenant-light loans, how do you enforce your covenants? How are you ensuring that the loans that you're issuing are not cov-light? Or, alternatively, what's your experience with working out these strategies when they do go bad? So if you lend to a company and it turns upside down, then how do you then work out that process? What are your recovery rates? What are the experience default rates? And what's your capacity to handle an influx of this kind of activity?
Ed, what are the trends that are driving that that to more covenant-like deals?
It's the market dynamic of having a lot of capital flow into the space and having a challenge putting it to work. And so it tends to be this supply-demand imbalance more than anything. Page 8 highlights a couple different types of direct lending. So I think we've talked a lot about first lien loans, and there are a few others on this table. Looking at first lien, unitranche, kind of a combination of first and second lien loans, and mezzanine. And mezzanine starts to get into more equity-like characteristics, depending on how those loans are structured and what the results of the companies are. But we have generally talked about first lien loans, and the leverage multiple. So here we go, EBITDA multiple, we're coming back to that again. It's saying 3 to 4x, meaning that the company's amount of leverage divided by its EBITDA is somewhere in a 3 to 4 multiple range. So that's not to be taken lightly, but not too significant either, in the sense that if you think about your own mortgage or something like that, you might think of what is the mortgage amount if it was a $500,000 loan against $10,000 income, that'd be a huge multiple. Against a $100,000 income, that becomes a 5 multiple. So that's kind of the same thing that we're working with here. Typical return of 6 to 7% range. And so this is, I think, one of the questions that we've had before in terms of what's the yield we should be seeing out of these and why hasn't our experience been better on that. So 6 to 7 is typical return, and we have some more details on that later. But That is what we should expect on these loans, and then they can be levered up from there, so we can expect 8 or 9%, depending on how the strategy is run. But this was, I think, one of the key questions, that when we take a look at our plans and our performance of these, we're not seeing that, and why? And so when we take a look at the individual strategies and what they've invested in, we know that they have had some failures, so some investment loans that haven't gone well, that have brought that total return to us down. And some of that is being extended out, and so hopefully we'll see the realization later than what we have so far. And some of it is, you know, the loans that they've issued haven't delivered what they expected to. And there is the selection issue with selecting private managers here, as we have in all of our strategies. So there are going to be better and worse, and we have a slide later on that's going to talk about that a little bit too. Page 9, we talk a little bit about the direct lending here, so recent clearing yields. So this is just comparing the direct lending column, the left-hand side, to syndicated loans and high yield. You see recent clearing yields, 7.4% for direct lending, which compares favorably to syndicated and high yield. The OID, the origination and fees to lender, they do have those, whereas the others have it occasionally. We see a shorter maturity, 4 to 8 years, which compares in line with syndicated loans, but less than high yield. First and second lien and senior seniority with call protection. So that tends to have some pretty good characteristics overall in terms of the space. If we flip forward a few pages from here, take a look at slide 11. Why invest? So here, the return enhancement, which is something that we see generally and with the space, more so than our particular experience. It is with the help of portfolio leverage, which is towards the end of that first bullet point. So investors can target a 9 to 12% net IRR. 12 might be the high side, but hopefully we can deliver an 8s to 9s. Reduced capital market exposure. So high contractual cash yield combined with covenants reduces our sensitivity to public debt and equity markets. That's probably something pretty important to us today as we watch what's been going on in October, November, and now into December with the public markets being quite volatile. These having less of that. And it's also interesting to think about the return and the nature of the return. So having positive returns is always nice. Having the returns come back to us in cash versus price appreciation is also nice, because that reduces our sensitivity to interest rates. And so having a high cash yield tends to be a favorable characteristic for pension plans. Reduced interest rate risk. So we haven't mentioned it earlier, but these tend to be floating rate instruments. And so when interest rates do go up, these also tick up with the rise in interest rates. They tend to be priced off LIBOR, and so we see a spread off LIBOR. Off those. And then J-curve mitigation as compared to some of the other private equity type structures.
Ed, are the CMEs that you presented earlier in the year, are they with no leverage?
CME.
Capital market.
Yeah. No, those are with leverage.
Okay. Yep. So will you be recommending leverage to the board later on as we...
I think each manager has leverage in it.
Oh,
I don't
okay.
know that I've seen
I don't
one
think
that
any
that
of our current managers do. I don't know if White Oak does or not, but I'm pretty... Yeah.
No.
I don't think Raven does either, or Medley.
So the rates that we're seeing, the returns that we're seeing, include the increased effect of the interest rate rises over the course of this last year. So they're actually higher than they would have been otherwise?
Yes, and they're all at the, yeah. Well,
oh dear.
They're pretty far along in their maturity, though. So they've realized a lot of the loans that had happened before. So as these funds mature, those realized loans aren't in the portfolio anymore, so we're not seeing that. That's already been returned to us.
And it includes the 3% more than public debt that we would have realized otherwise?
That's the estimate, yeah. So that's kind of the estimate for taking on the illiquidity of it all, for getting into this section of the market.
So if we subtracted 3%, would we... see something akin to public debt?
No, public debt has done better than that. Yeah. Depending on the time frame, but yeah. So I'm not sure if I'm fully answering your question.
You are.
Okay.
That was my assumption. I just wanted to make sure that I was tracking correct.
You're tracking correct. Direct lending in page 12, I think we've covered most of these points. Increased yield, improved credit quality, tactical de-risking relative to equities, has the inflation hedging component by virtue of it being floating rate. Private equity diversifies special situations of mezzanine and helps to mitigate the J curve. So direct lending in a private equity portfolio does that. And then capture market dislocation premium. The market dislocation premium is interesting too. I think we also talked a bit about this last time, that part of the original thesis for getting into private credit was that the banks were exiting the business, and so that created an opportunity for pension plans to come in and be a source of that capital. And that's still true. So when we look back at 2009, banks had about 26% of the market. So of the issuance in 2009, 26% of that came from banks. And that declined with some volatility, but in 2017, that was about 1.2%. So banks were almost completely out of the market. And then the first half of 2018, that's coming back to about 3.3%. So following the same process, the banks are, while stepping back into it lightly, aren't a major player and aren't near where they were in 2009.
No, I'm not tracking again. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So earlier when we were talking about Covenant and Light,
yes,
you said it was because there was more money coming into that space that they were reducing their covenants because they're hungry for the business. So how does that
jive with the banks?
With this,
yeah,
with the banks not?
So when the banks left it, mm-hmm, that created the void that private debt strategies could come in to satisfy it. They have done that. And so the capital raising that we've seen each year has grown and grown and grown. So there's more being raised today than there was last year, than there was the year before. So that has grown significantly. That's grown. The bank's exit and the bank's role has declined substantially. Now banks, so part of it was then, okay, in the Trump administration, the deregulation with banks, will that allow them to now re-enter? And maybe it will, but we're not seeing it actually manifest itself yet.
So the money's coming in, but it's not coming in from banks.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Page 13 outlines just kind of the spectrum of private credit versus other fixed income. And the table at the bottom, I think, is the most interesting in terms of the forecasts. And taking a look at here, we're showing a 10-year forecast of 6.9, a pretty high Sharpe ratio of 0.45, which continues to be part of the logic behind recommending it. Page 14, again, comparing it to other asset classes on risk and return components, favorable return on the left-hand side, favorable risk on the right-hand side. And then the next two pages are just some of the current views from our private markets research. This is private credit overall and discussing not just direct lending, but some of the other components as well. So some of the bullet points here relate to distressed debt or special situations or what have you. The first bullet point highlights that the median net IRR for the vintages of 2005 to 15 is 9.5. And I highlight that because when we talk about the private markets program, we've always talked about making a commitment to private markets on kind of a year-in, year-out basis, because what we commit to a strategy today will take several years to be employed and then several years thereafter to really be realized. And so it's not so much up to us to try to call when is a good year or a bad year for the private markets, because there will be some good years and bad years in that mix. And so it's a better approach to have a consistent allocation to it to continue maintaining it, recognizing it, that some will be better for putting money to work, some will be better for harvesting, but the diversification that you get by looking at a 10-year swath of returns here, 9.5, works out pretty well.
And two questions. I'm sorry, I want to go back to the money thing.
Okay.
Where is, if the money's not coming from banks, where is it coming from? Other pension funds or private guys like Soros or somebody or?
Pension funds are a huge piece of it, and it's what we're calling the private credit managers. So the growth of their industry.
And my second question is, what's the good year and what's the bad year? So what would a bad year look like? What would a good year look like in terms of jumping in?
Yeah, so there might be a better slide that shows that. Page, if we jump ahead to page 20, I think that graphic is a handy one. On the left-hand side of page 20 at the bottom, you see the performance dispersion for those 13 years. So you can see the high, low, and median. So good can look really good, but it's been a while since we've seen something like that. So 01 and 02, 02 is pretty remarkable.
So since what were the characteristics that created that bounty, if you will?
To begin with, we had a higher interest rate environment there to begin with.
So if the Fed's raising rates, mm-hmm. that would be a harbinger of this asset class doing better?
It helps that, yeah. Yeah, because they're priced off LIBOR, so they're floating rate instruments.
Okay.
But to answer your question, 2000, 2001, 2002 were a very different world at that time. So the capital employed in this space was much less. So you had a better supply-demand imbalance there. Part of what we highlight in our slides, too, is that there is a lot of dry powder today, meaning that a lot of committed capital is in this market that is yet to be employed. And so, again, kind of leading to that cov-lite environment that, as it is seeking to be employed, it tends to look for lower restrictions, lower constraints on it. I think page 18 is probably a handy one. In terms of fund structures, there are multiple ways you can get to direct lending, or private credit. Direct lending funds on the left-hand side are what we have been talking about. For these reasons, just kind of as we go down here, size of the fund, minimum requirement or minimum commitment. It is illiquid. We see management fees of 1% to 2%, performance fees, and hurdle rates, and fund leverage is 0 to 2. And as you compare those characteristics across, you see that you generally have higher fees in the hedge funds with no hurdle rate. That's not such a good equation. Public BDC, we have higher management fees, slightly higher performance fees, again, no hurdle rate. Middle market CLOs, we tend to see higher leverage. So across these characteristics, it's why we still like the direct lending approach for getting the exposure, direct lending funds. Page 19 then compares the direct lending strategies to private equity strategies. So as we think more about building out our private markets program, we know we'll be getting into private equity. Those will have longer fund lives. It'll have longer investment periods, probably similar or higher management fees, similar or higher GP carry, so carried interest, performance fees, and most of the other characteristics are roughly in line.
Except for liquidity is basically the same on both sides?
None. You get no liquidity. Yeah. So when we go back through, I think the questions being asked were about performance and fees. And when it comes down to those two things, I think the fees are still noticeable. They aren't, you know, these strategies are not cheap. They're relatively cheaper than alternatives to get into the space, but they aren't low-cost vehicles. And the performance, I think, that we've seen from one of our three managers has been pretty solid. The other two don't seem to be good examples of what the space has generated for the other ones. And so we highlight that, you know, manager selection is a key piece of this, and we've talked about how we do the underwriting for that, both in terms of the investment policy statement and the addendum that's required to be filled out for you in advance of making the commitment, and go from there. If there are any questions?
So, Ed, as the banking environment, you know, your traditional banking environment, is that getting better in terms of putting more money in this space, or how does that, like, if the banking regulations were relaxed, then that reduces demand for this kind of space, right? So how does that impact the earnings potential here?
Yeah, so if banks came back in the way they did or the way they were back in 2009, mm-hmm. that would be a game changer. I think what we're seeing so far, though, is that that's not been the case. So the 2009 to current changes in banking regulations have been significant, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. And so when we look at kind of Basel II, Basel III requirements, that has changed the calculus for banks in terms of risk-weighted capital and what they must do to reserve against that. Even if there's a lightening of regulations, we don't think we're going back to that. Mm-hmm. So it could, at the margin, be an increase for banks to re-enter this market in some small step, and I think that's what we're seeing in 2018. But it doesn't look like it's a game changer in terms of them stepping back in a meaningful
like
way.
Used to be.
Right. So for me, the bigger concern isn't so much banks re-entering, it's more just all of the committed capital that's sitting
they're
out
already
there. Which really represents the same problem, because what do we care about where the source of money is? It's there.
It's there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
So is that, but in your professional opinion, we still need some allocation in this space? Or I mean, has that ship just left? I think, are we behind the curve on that? Or
no, I think there are still the loans being written and the companies paying them off, that is something that we want to get exposure to. I think the risks and the work that the managers have to do is incrementally more challenging. So putting that money to work in a smart way is that much more difficult. Being sure that they can work out and get recovery for any loans that go bad is that much more difficult. If we do face an economic recession and some of these companies that we're loaning to don't survive, it'll be that much more difficult. So I think there are challenges and there are headwinds ahead, but we don't know today how any of those will really be worked out. I mean, how the economy is going to evolve. So right now, we're in kind of choppy waters, and there's a lot of speculation about this, that, and the other thing, be it domestic or abroad, and that's weighing heavily on the markets. Those things will tend to pass over time, as they always do, and we'll have a new set of issues to wrestle with, and we'll see how those unfold. But you know, none of this is going to be clear as a day, and I could guarantee
sure.
you a return. I'd love to, but I'd get fired, and I'd probably be wrong. So I'm not going to do that.
That's why we hired you.
It's in your contract.
See, now we're back to me being fired again. See,
do you happen to have a slide of what our returns are? I didn't bring my handout from last month.
Oh, yeah, because our flash reports don't have private market returns.
I can tell
returns.
You.
Yeah.
They're, you mean the asset class overall?
I mean the individual.
Yeah, I can get you real close.
Okay.
So the Raven One fund is around 2%. It's actually been trending upward. Medley has been falling. It is down to about the same thing, about 2%, and then White Oak was about at 7.5% last time I looked, and Raven 3 has been actually doing fairly well early on, and they are between 3% and 4% now, but it's still, I know that doesn't sound like much, but they're still very early in the investment period with them. So, and then in general, we're looking at about a 3.5% on the asset class. Medley's been writing down a lot of loans lately. Over the last year.
So if we took off that 3% premium that we get?
We're back to zero?
There was no premium.
No, I mean against
premium. No, I mean, we're not earning a premium right now.
We're really not earning a premium on this, for the illiquidity in this asset class, we're not earning any premium at all. And that comes from the fees.
That's part of it, yes. It's also part of the ability of the manager to source good deals. I mean, we're seeing that right now in the later stages, the harvest period of some of these funds. I didn't see the write-downs that I'm seeing right now over the past year. So I don't know if that's typical of what some funds do is when they start to get to the end. I don't have the experience there to know that question. I mean, there's probably people in the room here that can answer that question. But that's what I'm seeing right now.
There's a manager selection component to this, for sure.
Yeah, I would think.
That's more true in private markets, we think, than in anywhere else. I think you have that issue in public markets as well, but with public markets, you always have the default of just going passive.
Yeah.
And you have the ability to say, I'm not good at picking managers, I don't like the fees, I'm just going to go lowest cost solution, get the index. And you can be pretty darn right with that approach. We don't have that option here, and so we're still seeing that as these are inefficient markets, the disparity in returns is significant, and picking the right managers is pretty key. I think we have, we're kind of one out of three on our manager picks.
A mixed bag.
Yeah, we have a mixed bag.
Any questions for Ed?
Before we move on, any convictions one way or the other? I mean, is this still a comfortable asset class for us to be looking at? I guess that's.
Well, my thought is Ed gets a pass on this because we were sold into the
before
he came.
That's true.
So he really doesn't have a skin in the game. So I think the next go around is he needs to come to us and say, I think you should go forward, or I don't think you should go forward, and then it's an end discussion. And we reallocate the money somewhere else. But he needs to come and say, I think you should go forward, look at these managers, and here's why I think you'll get a better result. And I think that's what we do pay him for.
And that's kind of the difference, I think, between today and yesterday. Mm-hmm. Because the environment definitely is more challenging, it sounds like. But also the expectations are lower, too.
I think one of the deals that hasn't come up yet, I think our restriction was that there can't be any leverage on any of them. I don't think we have leverage on any
gotcha.
Of it. Yeah. Yeah. Which would tend to depress the returns
this time around, but that could change later on, too.
Well, it could, but he's going to need to explain that and then got to live with it.
Right.
Okay. All comes back to you, Ed.
So how do we pursue that suggestion? Does he come back and report back to us later?
I would like to hear his recommendations going forward. Okay. Unless the majority of the group says, we're sick of this, we don't even want to hear about a recommendation.
When they're writing down these loans, how much are they writing these loans down?
It depends.
10%, 20%?
Oh, no. We're probably talking 3%, 4% max would be on the high side, but that's still a lot of money. So. Next month or February, we have much more detailed information and data that we're going to be presenting to the board on these very issues, too. So you'll be able to get a much more in-depth look at what's causing the changes in the returns from quarter to quarter and what's causing changes specifically in the fund balance from quarter to quarter. So it may give you a little more illumination on what's driving this and the magnitude.
I'm not necessarily afraid of the class. I'd like to continue to explore it because I think there's still some opportunity there. We just have to be able to ferret out what's the best opportunity for us. Because, I mean, like you said, White Oak has the 7.5%. I mean, to me, that's a winner. And we just didn't pick winners on the other ones.
Well, I think the slide on page 20 says a lot on the left-hand side to getting to your point exactly, Mike. I mean, we got to figure out, pull the rabbit out of the hat here and figure out how to
pull somebody out of that top quartile. That's really what this is all about.
Yeah.
And the variability there is great.
Council, so, I think it's worth continuing to explore.
So is there any urgency to take action today or next month?
No, I think we go back and make recommendations as we go forward. I think we're really more concerned about your thoughts on the asset class in general and whether the past experience has perhaps tainted your view of this asset class and how much time and effort we put into this.
And to Trustee Grover's point, I think coming back in early next year, I'm guessing it'll be the February meeting when we'll have a more detailed discussion about the asset allocation and the assumptions. We'll have updated numbers on our view for private credit as well as all the other asset classes, so we can talk about that. When we hear from White Oak today, I don't think that we're expecting any board decision at that time either, so we'll continue our underwriting process with that and come back to you with a recommendation on what to do there. So I think we're heading in that direction. We're not there yet, but that's where we're getting to.
And to answer your question specifically for my part, I have some issues with the asset class. So when we have a discussion in February, we should make it in depth.
All right. So let us know what your concerns are.
We'll do.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to share now so we can get
No, not just very generic.
They can funnel anything through me until
fees.
Then.
Because the fees are what depress the returns on that asset class.
Well, yeah, and a couple bad loans.
But I mean, the fees are higher in that asset class than they are in many other asset classes. So for me, that's one of the issues.
Any other comments for Ed on this, you guys? Are we ready for White Oak?
Are they ready for us?
You're sure.
Welcome.
While they're getting ready, let me give you a little brief overview of this. This is item 6B. It's a private debt fund structure presentation from White Oak Advisors, and this is an information item only. Just as a little background, we currently have about $95 million invested in our entire direct lending portfolio. The target was and is today currently around $125 million, so we're somewhat short of that. We never actually did hit that target. And so over the next several months, that allocation, since most of the two-thirds of the money invested in this asset class are in the harvest period, it's going to start to bleed down even more, and that percentage will decrease even more. So what we've been doing, I've been talking with Ed, and I've been talking with Landy from White Oak, entertaining the idea of an evergreen-type fund. An evergreen-type fund would give us a little more mobility and nimbleness in our ability to move money into and out of the fund. We could get up to the allocation target much, much faster this way. It has greater liquidity, so if we wanted to get out of the fund or we changed our view on the asset class in general, it would also give us some tools there that we don't currently have. And so what we're looking at today is to just listen to the fund structure type. They're going to compare it to what we currently have with them. And we're not asking you for any decision right now, but we just kind of want to get your thoughts on whether this type of fund structure would be something that you would consider going forward. And with that, I'll turn it over to the folks from White Oak.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rick. So my name's Landy Feelong. I've been here a few times over 5 years or so that you've been investing with us. And nice to see you all again. To my left is Tom Oddy, who's one of the senior members of the executive committee at White Oak and also heads up our asset-based lending division, which is now around about half of the assets that we deploy are in his command. So I thought it was a good idea for you to meet him. He'll tell you what he's been doing and give you a bit of an overview of that portion of our direct lending operations. And further to my left is Teresa Cutter. She is the head of our investor relations committee, and she's going to be talking a little bit about the current performance of the Pinnacle Fund. That's the investment that you already have with us. It was a tough act to follow with Ed there, but there's a lot of interesting things that I picked up that it's good to hear again. And we'll go through that today too. I think manager selection is a big point that I'd like to reiterate. You know, we've been with you for 5 years now, and we've delivered an IRR of 7.5%. With that liquidity premium that you're talking about, that's 4.5%. It compares to the fixed income portfolio that you could invest in. So we've sort of met our targets that we wanted to offer you. We've been a vehicle for you for diversification. We're not subject to the wild swings that's going on in both the fixed income and the equity market right now. We've delivered you a 7.5% yield all the way through that. I'm stealing a little bit of Teresa's thunder, but she was going to go. But it was interesting to hear you point to those sort of things as important to you. It's important to us too. I mean, that's been our mission. We've been trying to do that. We have and have delivered. Teresa will tell you a little about where we are on the fund, but you're running down now. Your exposure to us is getting less and less, just as it is to the other managers that you're allocated to in the space, as Rick pointed out. So you're under-allocated in this space. So we'll talk to you about a vehicle that we like, which a couple of vehicles, and you can choose between the benefits of each, that offer an evergreen exposure to the space. So it doesn't run out like we're in the process of doing right now. I'll hand it over to Tom, and he can introduce himself and give you a bit of a feel for a reminder of what White Oak does and ABL.
So my name, again, is is Tom Oddy, and I joined White Oak about 7 years ago to help build an asset-based lending business within White Oak. But my background is really 35-plus years in lending. So when you look at lending and cycles, as we say, I've seen a lot of movies, and that's what helps you kind of project what might be the next movie. My background goes from banking when I grew up in the Chicago area, and I worked in a bank in Chicago for 10 years, and then I went to General Electric, or GE Capital, and spent 20 years at GE Capital building businesses and lending in different products and in different markets, internationally and domestically. And then the last 10 years of my career, the last 15 years of my career, have been in fund management, both on the hedge fund as well as, in joining White Oak 6 years ago. And recap with some numbers on what White Oak is all about since, where we are today. And it's changed a lot from when I joined, in 2013. But today, you talked about a little bit earlier, Ed, how, the market of direct lending is focused on businesses that have, generally less than a $50 million of EBITDA. And that's generally what we focus on. And we use an enterprise value metric, which means you just take that EBITDA and multiply it by whatever multiple you think that industry should go for. So if it's a 6 multiple, you're looking at a $300 million enterprise business. But we focus on businesses between $5 and $1 billion in enterprise values. And we have today roughly $6 billion, or just $5.6 billion of assets under management. When I joined in 2013, we had, you probably know better than I do, I think it was just under $1 billion. So in the period, we've had the opportunity to grow, and it's been very exciting to be at White Oak and do that. And we've originated $7 billion of capital over our lifetime since 2008. And today, when I joined, we were probably, 40, 50 people, associates. Today, we're 400 plus, and we have offices across the United States and internationally in London as well. And we have a pipeline, which is what's very important for all of you to look at opportunities. We have a pipeline of $4 billion plus of actionable opportunities today. So one of the things you were talking about, Don, and everybody in the market about the banks, and I will just say that, the banks kind of, in my viewpoint over the period of time, as the banks went through the crisis, the banks kind of walked away from the under $50 billion EBITDA market. And as a result, that's where these direct lenders started to come in and fill the gaps where banks could not help middle market people or middle market companies grow and meet their requirements going forward. So I view it as an opportunity for us in this market space. And then secondly, you were talking, about the recession coming. In lending, in my years at GE, we actually looked forward to a recession, because a recession created more opportunities in the marketplace because, again, banks pull back from that segment of the market and they are reactionary, and that creates even better opportunities, which you can see in the historical data for the recessions going forward. What makes White Oak a little bit different is that we are not, we talked about Covenant Lights, and we are not a Covenant Light lender. So Covenant Light lenders are generally tied to private lending, making leveraged loans to private equity-owned companies. Only about, we're about 80% non-private equity-based. So we look to go out and use our direct calling and origination efforts to find companies in the middle market space that are not private equity sponsored. And as a result, because there is an arbitrage there in the market, you're not dealing with a major KKR firm where you're negotiating on covenants. You're dealing with an entrepreneur who needs money to grow his business, and he's willing to, you know, trade that and get covenants that make rational sense. So we set up 4 or 5 different covenants in every transaction that we do. The covenants can be anything from a leverage covenant to a profitability covenant to a even an asset turnover covenant. And we set these covenant levels so that we actually can start a yellow light as opposed to waiting till the end. So when these covenants trip, we can say, you know what, this is a yellow light. It's a reason to come and have a discussion with us and the company to find out where is it going, what's going not the way you project it. And so we use that as kind of an indicator, and so we do use covenants. The other thing, and so then we underwrite our transactions in a little bit different than a lot of other people. We use what we call a private equity underwriting process, which the underwriting process is focused not only on just doing your normal forward projections, looking at the historical information and rolling the historicals forward to make sure they make rational sense, but we engage third parties from industry experts to come in and evaluate whether or not the management's assumptions going forward are repeatable and that the business can be, is it a business that can keep, be profitable and grow and meet all the assumptions that we're underwriting going forward. So with that, I just will also make one last differentiator about us, which Landy asked me to do, which is we're a little different than most direct lenders in that our mix is not just, you know, term loans. We are also do, as I came to join White Oak, we do asset-based loans. And asset-based loans are nothing more than working capital loans that are loans against receivables and inventories, which are self-liquidating, if you think about it, because most receivables and inventories turn 3 to 4 times a year. And then we also have an equipment business. And the equipment business is also secured by specific assets. So we have a, you know, a very, you know, what I would say, strong collateral base. And our business today is roughly 45% equipment and asset-based lending. So with that, I'll just stop and see if there's any questions.
What's your hurdle rate?
I'm going to turn it over to
the man. I'll get through to that in a minute. We've got a couple of different opportunities we want to show you. So
okay.
They have different ones.
Any other questions?
So my name is Teresa Cutter. I'm the head of investor relations. And basically my team, we have one job, and that's just to make sure that you're happy. I'm here because I haven't gotten a chance to meet any of you. And I wanted to come out here and let you know that we really value our relationship. I understand from Landy, we've been talking to you since the summer of 2013. And just to give you a little bit about my background, I previously worked at California State Teachers Retirement System, CalSTRS. I managed the external managers, so high yield, bank loans, opportunistic debt, emerging market debt. I did not have the pleasure to manage a private debt manager, but somewhat related and relevant. I also worked at Ferris. I know this gentleman. You're in great hands. Very much respect Veris's research. Following maternity leave, I joined a White Oak private debt manager that I really liked. And I think the key summary in terms of why we're different is, you know, we're non-sponsored, we're self-originating. We have asset-based loans, which is a bit unique compared to the other managers that are out there. That's what Tom heads up. We've got the equipment-based loans, so we have collateral and assets backing up our cash-based loans. Also important to what Ed talked about, looking for high cash yield in these managers. Our manager, we ourselves rank, we have about 10 to 14% in cash yield, 10 to 12%. Depending on the type of loan that you're involved in, whether it's a term loan, asset-based loan, equipment-based loan. Our tenor is short, On average, for the Pinnacle portfolio, we've got 3 to 4 years, so that lowers your sensitivity to interest rate rises. That helps. And in terms of your performance, we've mentioned that 7.5% number gross. We returned 11%. Net to you, 7.5%. Yes, the fees are, it's a very labor-intensive business. Just for our factoring portfolio alone, we look at 1 million invoices every year. We process every single piece of paper. So it is labor-intensive. It costs us money to manage it. But you gave us 40, we gave you back 37, and your current portfolio is worth about just a hair under 30 million. So we really enjoy performing for you, and we find the relationship very valuable. We'd love to continue doing that for you.
Thanks, Fraser. So my objective is to give you a feel for two different ways we can create an evergreen investment in White Oak. Rick and I have been talking over the last few years about ways to keep the White Oak investment going, if you guys, of course, like the concept. But there's lots of different ways of doing it. There's a closed-end fund, which we've currently invested in. You have two other closed-end managers. You have an open-end fund called the White Oak Fixed Income Fund, and there's a possibility to create a separately managed account or fund of one for you as well. They all have different benefits and reasons why they're good and some why they're not so good. So I want to go through all that with you today just to give you a feel for the different types of offerings that we can make for you. I've summarized it all really on page 8 of the presentation here. There's the combination here on the left-hand side is the White Oak Fixed Income Fund, which is our fund that we have open in the market right now, has been open since September 2014, and on the right-hand side is a parallel fund of one, a fund that we could create specifically for you. I'll start a little bit with the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. September 14, it was seeded by the Getty Foundation. They gave us $85 million, and they've subsequently given us another $15 million. So they were the ability to get this fund going. Since then, we've now got about $350 million in the fund. The strategy is pretty much the same as all the strategies that we have at White Oak. We've got a lot of different vehicles. We manage money for state funds, public funds, Taft-Hartley funds. They all basically have the same strategy that Tom and Teresa have been talking about today, this unsponsored direct lending strategy. But the vehicles change. So with the White Oak Fixed Income Fund at $350 million, those assets are the same assets that they're in practically all our other funds. The idea of this structure was to be an evergreen investment, and that means that we'll just keep investing your money till you tell us to stop. That's basically an evergreen fund. But it's got to have some other functions about it. And how do you get in? Well, normally with a closed-end fund, it's a drawdown situation. You would commit $40 or $50 million, and then as the loans come, we would call those that money away from you. With this situation here, it's a pay it all up front. So if you want to do $10 million, you can do it at any quarter end of the year. We would then hold that money in our cash management or liquidity management sort of with structure within the fund. We put it in government funds, really, basically small short-term government loans. And we would draw out of that pool when the next loan comes. So rather than have the money sit with you and you've got it with your liquidity manager, it's actually with us, and we're managing it until the next loan comes up. But what that does is you buy into the fund on March 30th, if you allocate to us, on April 1st, you've got an allocation of that exact amount in our strategy. No J-curve, in other words. You don't have to wait before you get your money to work. It goes to work the very next day. That's the concept of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. On the way out, it's a little bit different. What we've done is tried to emulate the same sort of situation that our largest investors have. Our largest investors have separately managed accounts or fund of ones. And the idea for them is that if they want to get out, they just tell us, we want to liquidate half of it, or we we would like to lower our commitment to White Oak by 50% or whatever, what we do is we just stop reinvesting. So the same thing happens with the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. If you would like to reduce your exposure by a certain percentage or in total, all you have to do is tell us stop reinvesting and we'll do that. The actual mechanics of that I'll get into in a second. But both the White Oak Fixed Income Fund and the Parallel Fund of One have that same evergreen structure. They have that same ability for you to get liquidity when in a more reasonable fashion. So if you decide to get out, you can get out at all or a portion of it. The structure of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund is a Delaware private partnership. The structure of a Parallel Fund of One would be the same sort of thing. We would create a fund for you. The idea why we were talking about the Fund of One was that you already have the investment in Pinnacle Fund. So rather than just continually let it run off, you can put it in this fund. As it runs off, we'll reinvest the money. That was the concept that Rick and I discussed. It just makes it one step easier for you. You don't have to keep transferring money back and forward. We would do that for you. And we would end up with a fund equivalent to, say, $50 million that you would have exposed to all the new loans as they come through. And sitting within that Fund of One would be a Pinnacle Fund, which would gradually get smaller and smaller. It would be a less and less position. So in a couple of years' time, that Pinnacle Fund will run off. It's not worth anything. And you would then have in this Fund of One a number of different loans. It's the same loans, the same concept. They would be it's just a different vehicle. So the difference with the liquidity is practically the same. The liquidity of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund is you tell us you'd like to reduce your exposure by a certain amount. In 6 months' time, we would carve that amount off. If it's the whole amount of the investment, we would carve that whole amount out of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. We put it in a separate sleeve. And then as those loans mature, then you would get your money back. So the same sort of thing would happen with a Fund of One. You wouldn't have quite the flexibility of reducing it by a smaller amount. $50 million is our minimum for a Fund of One. And so if you wanted to reduce your commitment to 25, that would be much more difficult. But in the White Oak Fixed Income Fund, that's not a problem. You can go up and down whatever you want. That's another point. In either of those two vehicles, if you wanted to add an extra $5 million next year, it's simple to do. You don't have to sign more documents. It's already in the agreement that you would sign. If you just elect to do so, you can do so. The dividend of the fund would be about the same. It's the same loans. It's just a different vehicle. The fund has been running, White Oak Fixed Income Fund has been running at 7.5% yield for the last couple of years. That's what we would expect going forward. So that's what you would that's what you should get with the either investment. J-curve, I think I mentioned that. There is a J-curve effect. If you use the Fund of One, you would have to draw down the funds as the loans were originated, so you wouldn't have all your money put to work at once. With an investment in the White Oak Fixed Income Fund, you invest all your money at once. There is no J-curve. Quite a popular feature for people like yourselves that have an allocation that want to meet it. You can meet the allocation straight away rather than say, yes, we'd like to allocate more to this, and it takes 2 or 3 years before you get that commitment in place. There'll be the same sort of number of loans in the portfolio, whether you're in the White Oak Fixed Income Fund or Parallel Fund of One, about 35 to 40 loans. That's what we've been doing for the last 10 years in these funds, and that's about what we'd expect to do going forward. The fund will have a slightly different makeup. So the White Oak Fixed Income Fund will have a slightly different makeup to the Parallel Fund of One. As I mentioned, the Parallel Fund of One would have Pinnacle, which would decrease over time, and it would have new loans as we put them in. With the White Oak Fixed Income Fund, it would have the loans, you'd have the same strategy that we would have, but we also have cash that you and maybe another investor might add as we move on in time. So We expect the cash or liquidity portion of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund to be about 10%. Currently, it's much lower than that. It's around about 2 or 3%. But there is always a liquid component to the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. It's just the structure of the fund. If new investors like yourself come up and you add to the money to the fund, you add $10 million, and there's $10 million worth of extra liquidity in that fund. So the returns of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund are slightly lower than the returns of any other vehicle that we have, including this parallel fund of one. And the reason why is due to the fact that it carries this certain amount of cash or liquid investments in it. What are the differences? We expect a White Oak Fixed Income Fund to run about 8%, and we expect the parallel fund one to run around about 9%. So a percent different.
And is that almost entirely due to the cash drag?
It is entirely due to the cash drag, exactly. In fact, that's our expectations at the moment. They're both running at about the same. So and that's because we got very little cash in there. I was just talking to Rick earlier, and we were saying that we expect that the difference will decrease as the size of the White Oak Fixed Income Fund grows. As it gets larger and the investments are relatively smaller, then the cash impact is also relatively smaller.
So then I asked Landy, I said, why would anybody choose the fund of one? Why wouldn't you just go with the fixed income fund? And I think one of the answers I got from you was that there is a little more of an air of customization in the fund of one as opposed to this. Any other reason why one would choose the fund? Because talking with you at lunch today, that was really in the back of my mind. Why would we go with the fund of one and not?
Our largest investors tend to use fund of ones. They like to have their own administrator rather than to use ours. They like to be able to customize the portfolio if they want to.
In what way?
They could restrict it geographically. They could say, I don't want you investing anywhere but the United States. They could customize it. We already have a large exposure to the oil industry or to natural gas industry or to chemical industry and say, please don't invest any more in that. That is really the only two benefits of having a separately managed account. If you look to this, you know, large investor like the state of Arizona, who is one of ours, all of their direct lending managers do it in a fund of one, and they all use their custodian. So I think that's, for their side, it's much more convenient. And they hardly, well, actually, they have been customizing their portfolio a little bit, so I don't know how important that is to you.
Well, I mean, we've had issues in the past with certain investments that the board seemed to have some distaste towards, so it may be of consideration when we decide this.
Well, something that came up today also was fees. The current fund, you're paying 1.75% management fee and 17%, I think, or maybe 15% carry. They were cheap, actually, at the time, but now the marketplace has pushed those fees down. We would be offering in these two structures significantly lower fees than that. Before I go on to that, though, something that Ed brought up, which was interesting. Some managers, and I forgot this, don't rebate back to you the fees for prepays and for other fees. All the fees that we generate through structuring the loans are your fees. So, in fact, that's part of our strategy. Nearly all of our loans prepay early. So we would do a three-year loan, they finish in 2 years, then they owe us a fee. That's your fee. So we don't take any of those, but thanks for Ed for pointing it out. Some managers do, and that would increase the amount of fees that you have to pay. With these two structures, though, the White Oak Fixed Income Fund has the slightly lower fees in a couple of different ways. When I talk about fees, there's manager's fees, carry, which is the performance fee, and then there's administrative fees. With the administrative fees, the White Oak Fixed Income Fund has no startup costs because it's already been going since September 2014. There would be a startup cost. You've got to get the lawyers to write up forms, and I estimated that's around about $75,000 to form a fund of one. If you've got a $200 or $300 million account, that's insignificant. With a $50 million account, it means something. Also on the management fee side, the management fee for the Fund of One, for the White Oak Fixed Income Fund is 1%. The other one is 1%. But the carry is smaller. The carry or the performance fee for the White Oak Fixed Income Fund is only 10%. The carry for the Parallel Fund of One is 15%. The hurdle is 6.5% for the Parallel Fund, and it's only 5% for the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. So just reducing all those numbers, it's cheaper to be in the White Oak Fixed Income Fund. As that fund grows, it will get cheaper still because there'll be more common investors to share the administrative costs. You know, if it was one or the other, I think I'd prefer a few guys White Oak Fixed Income Fund, but it's not my decision. Rick asked me to show you both these structures out there so you can have a look at it and think about it and whatever you'd like.
Lindy, would there be a fee netting of any sort between the Fund of One and the...
Thank you for pointing that out, yes. There would be no extra fees charged on the residual or the legacy Pinnacle Fund because you're already paying fees on that. So, yes, that would be all removed from the equation. It would mean that you would be paying quite small fees to start off with, and then you would end up, but you're still paying the Pinnacle Fund fees. I don't know. It's a lot of information to digest in one hit, and you know, maybe go through this, and if you have any questions, please come back to me. But I have included in the previous page some data on the White Oak Fixed Income Fund, the fund that you could consider buying into. And, you know, you can see that it's got a diverse portfolio of investments in it already. It's been yielding at the moment 8.5%. That's its current yield since inception. The difference between the IRR, gross IRR, and the net IRR, something that was brought up earlier, is significantly smaller because there's less fees in that fund. 9%, 9.5% gross, 8.5% net is the spread. We've also got the fees per quarter. If you look at those fees,
Donna's breathing down again.
If you look at the performance per quarter, you can look at the performance that this fund has had through quite difficult times for the markets. They're steady. They're really, you know, every quarter, either 2 to 3% return. It just churns out the dividend as it's meant to do. This is a vehicle and a product which I think performs as you would like a direct lending product to perform. It gives you a diversified portfolio of, as Tom said, unsponsored loans, both ABL, term loans, and equipment finance loans. And it gives you the opportunity to get in straight away and get out when you want. There's no lockup on this fund. We've only had two investors decide to get out of the fund since it started in 2014, but everybody has the opportunity to do that any time. It gives you the versatility to either add more money if you want to allocate more to us and to the sector, or if the reverse is true, you can reduce that. And if you don't do anything, we'll just keep churning out loans and giving you a yield.
I have one question.
Yes.
We invested with you and with two other firms.
Correct.
At approximately the same time. And the other two firms, you know, we have issues with. You guys have been absolutely great.
Thank you.
What do you do differently? And it's kind of a softball question.
Yeah.
What do you do differently than those other two firms did?
Well, I can't speak to Medley and Raven, but I can tell you what we do. And I think you'll find that we've got significantly more employees than either of those two companies. We've got a very structured process involved in how we look at loans, how we analyze loans, whether we fund them, and then after that, how we monitor them. We've also got a very rigid focus on covenants. I don't know what they do. And maybe theirs is less, maybe not. But I think also, as Tom was mentioning, our diversification of investments. So we've got only about half our loans are term loans, and the rest are either ABL or equipment finance. ABL is a great loan, asset-based lending. But a really simple example is a lamp manufacturer sells to Walmart. Walmart gets all these lamps, and they look at them, yep, these are great, we'll pay you in 90 days. And then we lend money to the lamp manufacturer, and Walmart pays us back. So we've taken a small company with not so good credit and surplused it with what comes from Walmart. Not only does it come from Walmart, it comes into our bank account first. So we take out what we need and we give it back to the small company. The collateral is not the company itself, not the lamps, but cash from Walmart.
Got it.
And that's really safe. Right? I think over the last 2 or 3 years, maybe 5 years, we've been trying to work out how to de-risk our portfolio. And Tom joins us, shows us this ABL business, and we've been in all in. it's a great business.
Not going. But it's also structuring. I think when you structure these loans, you need to set up the right milestones, not just through covenants, but you need to set up kind of the right collateral and monitoring metrics to make sure that that we're on top of that credit at all time, that we're monitoring that loan to value, if you want to call it that, from perspective. So I think it's structuring skills. It's just it's the overall process, everything else, the people, our process, and our systems. I think you've seen some of our systems. I think we have a great team and a great group of people. And as Lanny said, we have a very strong and tight process, and we have a lot of checklists that we have to check off. Some I view as, but we check them off, and we check them off because we view it as something of value to our investors to make sure we've done that.
Talking about systems, we've spent a lot of money
right.
creating a system to make sure that all those check boxes are checked and yep. in place. We use the Salesforce CRM, we use their workflow methodology. And so we've put our 48 steps for every loan into that process so that if there's no tick box on tick box number 7, you can't get to tick box number 8. If the document is not stored in number 9, you can't get to number 10. You need that because we look at a lot of loans. I mean, a lot. And so if you've got a good system, a good process, and make sure it happens, I think you're going to do better with the process. The whole direct lending space depends on, how it's done. But the concept is great. You've got, you lend money to a company and you make sure you've got twice as much in assets. You watch them like a hawk. You should get your money back, right? I mean, you've got a good start. And I think if you got good people doing it, you'll get good returns out of the space.
Okay. Thank you. Members, any questions?
So the portion of money that you're not able to lend against, so that sits in the fund?
Mm. Yes. So, if a new entrant would come to the White Oak Fixed Income Fund and give us $10 million, that sits within the fund. Mm. We have a manager, Greg Stilson, and his team. They manage the cash. They buy short-term government agency loans, and then as we need them, he sells them, and we invest in the loan. Our objective with that liquid portion of the fund is to get 2-2.5%. We've been doing a little bit better than that recently as the rates have gone up. Mm-hmm. When about 3-4 years ago, we were only getting about 0.5-1% for it. Mm-hmm. So that's now working in your favor. It doesn't hurt you as much as it used to.
And about what portion is that?
Out of the total fund, our objective is to make it about 10% of the fund. But just recently, we're down to about 3% of the fund because we had a couple of opportunities. And then we're going to get some new money in at the end of this month. And so it'll expand a little bit. As the fund gets bigger and bigger, I think the portion that's not in direct lending will get less and less.
As a percent.
Right. Correct.
As the fund gets bigger and bigger, would the number of outstanding loans increase, or would you cap the size of the fund at some point?
We haven't made a cap decision, but the number of funds is really depending what vehicle we have. It's all about the same, because it's the same live portfolio. So, we might have a new portfolio. It's only a couple of years old. It's probably got 30 to 40 loans. A portfolio that's 10 years old, it's still only got 30 to 40 loans in it. So as it gets bigger and bigger, there'll be times when it'll get slightly more or less, but it'll probably stay around about the same.
Members, any questions?
Just
I'll just note that when the due diligence visited their office last year, they gave us a pretty detailed run-through on this Salesforce CRM. And my opinion, I don't know if you guys agree or not, is that they work a lot harder at monitoring the loans than what we've seen from them.
Okay.
In terms of their underwriting, they treat it more like a bank would.
I would concur with that.
Than deal makers.
That's good to know.
Thank you.
Any other questions? White Oak, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy holidays, everybody.
You too.
Safe trip back.
Yes.
No worries.
Thank you very much.
All right, so we'll get going here. Item 6C, this is a information and discussion item only, and the subject is private investment fund and tax accounting form presented by Natalie Elliott.
First thing I want to note is that the agenda says earlier this month, it was actually early last month that I attended this forum. It was November 7th to the 9th. It was put on by the Foundation Research Associates, and they actually emailed me and invited me to attend this forum because it had to do with tax and accounting for private equity funds and hedge funds. I thought it would be a good idea to further my understanding of how the accounting works for these types of investments. So I attended with approval from REF, and basically their tax and regulatory legislation is changing. And the SEC is changing as far as their regulatory process of watching out how these funds do their accounting. And it's driven by the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. It was really interesting, even though it was directed to the general partners, the tax accountants, and the auditors that audit these funds, it gave me more insight to the complexity of the accounting function for these funds. So it was very interesting. I learned a lot, and out of probably 50 people, I was the only limited partner representative there. So.
Thanks, Abby. All right, we'll go to 7A. Ed, you're up.
Again. Good afternoon, everyone. So I handed out the November flash report. So October was a rocky month, November a little bit more tranquil. Now we're into December. So I don't see anything particularly noteworthy across the investment strategies. Most of them performing in line with their benchmarks. Risk parity. We see some underperformance from AQR. This is on page 2 towards the bottom, with more than offset by the performance of Panagora. So continuing our philosophy of keeping those two diversified seems to be working well. And the current and policy roughly in line. So the big picture of having the asset allocation, we're sitting pretty much on top of our targets there. So that's all looking good.
Looks like the small caps really had a bad month. Yeah.
Certainly have, and the performance to date for domestic equities has brought them into negative territory as well, so we're not finding any safe havens in this environment. In fact, as of last week, and I'll bet it's still true today, cash was the best performing asset class.
Yeah, it is true today.
There's no good place.
Where's that rock?
Thanks, Ed.
You know what, though? I think that's a great point. Sorry, just that's one last right. second. In terms of the portfolio construction we're using with this functional approach of saying we have a large short-term gov credit portfolio so we can withstand rainy days, these are the rainy days, and so glad we have that because that is generating our 2 to 3% yield, and we'll take that in this environment while the growth portfolio goes through its gyrations. So.
Thank you. Next item.
Item 8A, this is the Information Technology Solutions Project Update. I'm going to kick it off with Dawn Lee, and then I'm going to have something to add when she's finished.
We are still on track with our utilization testing.
We are still testing calculators. As we've talked about, there are so many of them, so many different types. The most recent one that we did went so well, we didn't find a single bug in it, which was really exciting. Because before on all of the other ones, we found, you know, one or two little things here and there. But as always, TechEd has been great to get them fixed very quickly, and they turn around, send them back down, we do some more testing on them. So staff have been just excellent about getting that testing done. We've also cranked out several more of the ESRs, the documents. And so we've got a whole bunch more of those signed off in the last couple of weeks. So we've really got a lot accomplished in the last, it's been kind of a short period since our last board meeting, but a lot has happened. And so that part's going very, very well.
Thanks, Dawn. So I wanted to discuss an issue that has come up recently. We've hit the midpoint part of the project, and so generally what happens during the midpoint part of the project, we reevaluate and see where we are and see if any changes need to be made to the schedule going forward. We look at our resources that we have here in-house. We look at our resources that TechEd has to offer us. We look at our budget and so forth. So we consider a lot of things. And we've come to the, I'll state to the conclusion first, and then I'll tell the story a little more after I state the conclusion. We've come to the conclusion that we should extend the project deadline by about 5 to 5.5 months. It's not a large amount. It won't cost us any money. The only concern that we have, basically, is our current Tyler system. We're holding it together right now with glue and Band-Aids as much as we can. But we have done an assessment on the project, and we believe that we can squeeze at least another year or two more out of it if we absolutely had to, but it is a challenge. We could spend a little more money there trying to keep it up, but this is just an extension of 5 months. So that was our biggest concern. But the thing that really, I think, triggered it for us is that we looked at the resources that we have on hand today. We looked at the demands that staff would be faced with, trying to keep up with the current pace that TechEd has set. And we decided that this is probably in the best interest for the system and for the project is to give us a little more breathing room. We're actually still down 1.5 staff right now from where we should be. We've got a lot of staff changes happening now. We've got some staff changes that are happening in the future. And so, like I said, I think this will just give us a little more breathing room and be able to do a better job bringing rounding second base and bringing this project home over the next couple of years. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
You said it doesn't increase cost?
It does not, no. Again, there's actually the cost will remain the same. The timing of actually when we make those payments will change. It'll be spread over a longer period of time. So in that sense, we won't be paying as much in the short period of time, but paying it off in a longer period of time. But this does not increase costs with our project consultant, and it does not increase costs from our vendor as well. And essentially, it doesn't increase costs for staff as well, because we're not increasing their workload. They're going to still be doing the exact same things that they were going to do. We're just not compressing it into the time period that the original project timeline had.
They actually save a little bit, because we probably would have to be paying a lot in overtime.
We could, yes. That's true. And this is not, let me tell you something, this is not something, this is more from Stan Sarah's perspective. TechEd has already told us, if you guys want to keep to the current schedule, we'll bring staff in. It's not going to cost you any more money. We'll bring in, because you know this is what the timeline that we had actually agreed to, and we'll get the project in at the time we said it they would. But I have concerns about our ability to keep up with TechEd at this stage right now. It's been pretty difficult, maybe not too difficult up to this point, but it's not going to get any easier on staff as we go forward right now. So the cost of extending this out 4 or 5 months, I think, is very small, given the benefits that we're going to get from doing it. So we talked long and hard about it, and I made the decision that this is probably the best alternative for Stan Sarah's staff. I just wanted to get this out to you all so you understood.
Okay. I appreciate the baseball analogy. The other thing that you left out was that the current schedule it would be ending or going live, or whatever you want to call it, about the time they're doing their income tax stuff. And so that pressure point of doing income taxes and trying to get this thing live at the same time, I think is asking more than necessary, especially since we can move the date out it doesn't cost us anything to do it. It's relieving staff, stress off the staff.
Good point. A lot of the timing and the processes was kind of off in our current schedule to where we would go live and then have to do this do the COLA, which would be a new process immediately. And so instead, this will actually, by pushing the timeline out to when we did, the COLA is a good example, we'll have 5 or 6 or 7 months to make sure that the COLA process works before we actually have to use it to pay benefits. So it also gives us a little more breathing room. The schedule is more properly adjusted, I think, relative to our processes that we have right now.
Do we need a vote on this?
No. Okay. Rick, unless you have some issues with it.
Just, Rick, looking bigger picture, you talk about 1.5 staff. And maybe this is a later discussion. Is there anywhere else that we should expect something to be delayed? I don't know.
Not that I can foresee. No. Everything else, we're running pretty smoothly even on the project. It's going pretty good. It's just that we see down the road now, and we see potential roadblocks and headwinds, and we want to attack them and solve those issues now instead of getting halfway into this thing, this rounding third base and heading home. Then we really do have problems. We're just giving ourselves a little bit more breathing room. That's all.
Anyone object to this? All right. Next item.
Okay. Item 8B, Boardroom Committee Update. Natalie Elliott.
We finally have a fully executed contract with Heritage General Construction Company out of Fresno. The contract was signed with us Thursday. The permit was paid for and picked up, and Heritage General got their City of Modesto license yesterday. So due to the holidays, unfortunately, according to Heritage General, some of the suppliers that he uses closes during the holidays, during this time of year. So construction is not going to start until the week of January 7th. It's scheduled to be 8 weeks, so it should be finished by the first week in March for the contract. So hopefully.
And these meetings will be webcast live, right? Is that what's going to happen? So you have to.
That's the idea.
Set a dress code for everybody.
I always wear a suit.
Yeah, no, you're the one guy. Well, yeah.
But you'll be the president, so.
No, you're. Is there? Are you?
It's not going to be live stream meeting.
It's not.
No, but there will be audio and video on our website for the meetings.
So you can see the replays.
Seriously expensive and complicated for the audio video to do live streaming.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Natalie. Item 8C, this is the report on earnings allocation for fiscal year ended June 30th, 2008. This is an information item only, and Natalie Elliott will present this as well.
Okay. As Rick said, it is information only. It's to let you know that as for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2018, we had earnings available to distribute and allocate of $166.5 million. Those earnings were allocated in compliance with our excess earnings policy, and that calculation is on the back of the agenda item for your information. That's pretty much it. Unless you have questions.
All right. Item 8D. This is the revised travel and education policy. This is a discussion and action item, and staff's recommendation today will be to accept and approve the revised travel and education policy. So a couple weeks ago, the travel and education policy met, and they discussed some issues that staff had brought up where we needed clarification for issues that have come up in the past that we didn't really have clear policy, or parts of the current policy were not quite as accommodative as we would like to see them. So I'm just quickly going to run down the main three bullet points from this revised travel policy. The first one has to do with our old policy had a requirement that each trustee was to give a report, like almost a book report type thing, at board meetings after they attended events. It's never been done since I got here, and so I think before we, when we took a look at this year, before we thought we would impose anything on you folks, we decided we would let you weigh in and let us know if you think that you still want to do this. So the committee decided that trustees will be required to fill out a one-page summary of the conference attended, state what was beneficial and why they would recommend the conference to other trustees, if that's even applicable. Staff would then place the completed summary on the consent calendar for full board review, and we have a copy of that summary template in the back of attachment one. International travel was conditionally approved on a case-by-case basis, pending recommendation and justification from the director to the Internal Governance Committee. Meal receipt is to be on a per diem basis, which is what we have now, but we had some issues with some of the major metropolitan areas of the country being a little unaccommodative of our per diem amounts. And so staff recommended that the per diem with reasonableness based on travel to major metropolitan areas where per diems were inadequate. So if you're out there and the meals are a little more than reasonable expenses, more than what the per diem offers, then you just need to keep your receipts. I know we haven't been asking you to keep your receipts lately because of the per diem, but now if you need to, keep those receipts and turn them in. And then the final thing that the committee agreed to is that, and we didn't offer any specific guidance or solutions to this problem, but the committee confirmed the notion of moving to a more self-service type travel planning for staff and trustees, and most likely this is going to include working with either a travel agency or an application or even the state of California to create some sort of repository that makes it easier for us to book travel or for you to book your own travel and maintain your receipts and everything like that. It'll take a little pressure, I think, off Kelly because she does spend quite a bit of time with travel stuff for not only staff but the trustees as well. I don't know if you want to add anything to that part of it.
We have looked into several options and are looking at the most cost-effective with the GSA, the government, California, being something that we will probably bring back to you the soonest, which doesn't have a cost, and it would allow you to be able to book your flight, your hotel, and a car at a one-stop shop, at least get that off the ground and start with government rates and access to you without any startup fees. So, of course, I would still be able to help trustees that would not want to book their own travel, but it wouldn't tie your hands if you already know you're going to an event and want to get that on the books and possibly bring somebody else with you at your own cost and trying to coordinate that as well. So hopefully it'll assist trustees that want to book their travel and flight.
But you will still do booking for the hotel and the conference for the trustees? So
that yes.
Or the registration fee, I guess.
Registration.
Right. Sometimes we have noticed in the past that even though we get a conference rate, the government rate is sometimes cheaper. So it would be in our best interest to take whichever rate is cheapest, so we won't always have to take the conference rate per se. But yes, that would be given to you ahead of time, and if it's cheaper to book the government rate through the GSA website, then that's what we would offer.
So like going to Sackers, for example, you would still block off 6 rooms or something like that?
They're actually even doing things different there. Like they didn't do that this last time. You had to go in and individually book your rooms for all of them. They didn't just block off 10 rooms. So yes, behind the scenes, that's what we did, but it wasn't like Sackers normally did. We used to just submit 10 names or say, hold 10 rooms for Stan and Sarah, but that isn't what they're currently doing. They're also trying to look at revamping things because it's gotten difficult with systems over booking rooms, not using them, and then trustees who wanted to go didn't get a room. that type of stuff. So we're just looking at a more cost-effective way and ease for you guys to be able to book your own travel for the ones that want to.
Does the committee have anything to add to that?
We would book our own airline.
If you chose to, yes.
And I don't understand if we have to use a certain service or we just do it on our own.
We haven't chose one yet, but what we'll be bringing back to you probably at a later date is a service through the GSA that offers a government rate with accounting on file to where you wouldn't have to use your own payment and ask for reimbursements or anything like that. And they secure many different airlines. It's not just one airline. So it is for the government rate.
You know, a trip to New Orleans is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
That is too early to...
Yeah.
I mean, it's coming up too soon to make changes.
Yeah, we'll have to go through the IGC to actually put anything in place. So that won't happen before, I would say, even March's trip. So
you'll come back and say, okay, we're ready to go on this new process now.
Yes, we'll definitely bring it to you with some options. And
that trip ends on Mardi Gras weekend in New Orleans, so
yeah.
There might be a lot of demand for rooms.
Mm-hmm. So I'll still be booking anything, probably, I suspect, through March or May for me. So nothing will change probably for a while.
Mr. Chairman, I move the staff recommendation.
I just got a question before I go forward. On the last Exhibit B, the last item asked, would you recommend this event to other trustees? You have a choice of obviously yes or no. We're only asking you to document if it was good. So number five, describe what was good about the event. So in the event that I write no, we're going to require us to list why.
Would you like us to, you know, I thought about that. I actually did think about putting bad, but.
Good or bad?
Yeah, just highlight.
I can do that if you'd like.
I think you're going to get one or two responses.
All right. That's funny. But yeah, okay.
And then on the educational requirements, we don't know that. You get to fill
no,
that
Kelly's
in.
Going to fill okay. that in for you.
Most everything on Exhibit B will be filled out for you and distributed to you in your travel packet. The only thing that you would need to do is on number five about describe the event, what your likings and if you would recommend it. Everything else, your education credits, the name of the event, date, location, all of that will be pre-filled in for you with your travel packet.
Okay.
Second,
with the changes.
Okay. So moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Unanimously. And the next item is closed session.
Chairman, I'm moving. We move into closed session.
Second.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, we're back in public session. We had a discussion in executive session on the performance of our executive director and the unanimous conclusion of the board is that he has performed exceptionally well, absolutely professionally, and he has enormous leadership and information sharing skills that reach everyone's high comfort level. So we are now here in public session to discuss what we can do in terms of compensation of the executive director. He is at the highest range in his current classification. He's close to the highest range. We recommended in the committee, and that's Darren and Jim and I, that we take him to the maximum limit, the 2.39% increase in salary. We also indicated that it would be our preference in the future if the county gives to the management employees a COLA, that not just be absorbed because he's at the maximum band limit now, but that the county take steps to expand the band limit. So that if there is a 3% COLA for everyone in this classification, he isn't penalized because he's already at the maximum band limit. And that was our recommendation. Jim, do you have any comments?
No, I think that sums it up pretty well.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
So that's our recommendation. Is there a motion?
Motion.
A second.
Motion seconded, so let me... All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now we're in members' comment. Why don't we begin with Mr. Grover?
I wish you well.
Thank you very much.
Same here. Happy holidays to everyone.
Yes. Ditto here.
Happy holidays. Congratulations. Two things. Don, we'll miss you enormously. And January 7th, there will be a swearing-in ceremony at 4 p.m. in the board chamber. It's open to the public. Anyone who wanted to attend could.
Is this for you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I will be part of that. It'll be my own term this time, not the rest of Gordon's.
Okay.
Same here. Thank you, Don, for your service to the county. Appreciate it. You've been a real professional, a true professional all the time. Thanks.
Thank you, Don. Pleasure to meet you.
Jeff.
Congratulations, Don, and also happy holidays.
Staff is going to miss you a lot, Don, but congratulations. You earned it. And happy holidays, and we'll see you next year.
There's still time to change your mind. I just would like to point that out. I'll just put that out there.
Don, this is your last public comment, or your memory. Unless you change your mind, so.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, for letting me be a part of this team. And I'm going to miss all of you very much. And happy holidays. I hope everyone stays happy and healthy.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that the Form 700s are electronic this year, so you should be receiving those, and they will be going out probably right at the first of the year electronically. So touch bases with me if you have any difficulties. Your last year should be in there, so it should be easier this year than last year, but don't hesitate to ask for help if you need it.
And I want to thank you very much, Dawn, for your service and congratulate you. Your 22 years of experience here is, we just won't be able to make that up in any way, shape, or form. And your knowledge of this organization and its history has literally amazed me over time. So I just want to know how much I appreciate you and this whole organization will miss you.
Fred, you have?
No.
Jim?
Yes, congratulate Dawn on her retirement. I didn't realize you've been here 22 years.
It's still Sarah.
Yeah. 36 at the county.
36 at the county.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Jim, that's almost as old as you are.
I was only 3 years old when we started. Yeah. I would like everybody to consider having Mike Lance to the chairman for life.
Motion.
We would have to address the salary question.
Like Zijin Lynch.
Don, thank you. Thank you very much, Don, for and you can change your mind. This is not we never lock anyone in here. But I wish you all a happy holidays. Congratulations to Rick. And it's been a good year. No, even with the Trump market.
You can get things done without having to make a donation to the Clinton Foundation.
Well, apparently somebody should have donated something to somebody.